I think I'll go ahead at this point. I know our speaker is familiar to many of you and perhaps not to everyone. So let me just say a few words about David Loy, who's a longtime personal friend and a longtime friend of our community at this point. David is a professor, writer, and Zen teacher in the Sambo Kyodan tradition of Zen Buddhism. He's a prolific author whose essays and books have been translated into a number of languages. David's articles regularly appear in the pages of Buddhist magazines, including Tricycle, Lion's Roar, and Buddha Dharma, as well as in a number of scholarly journals. His most recent book is called Eco-Dharma, Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. David teaches nationally and internationally on a variety of topics, focusing primarily on the encounter between Buddhism and modernity, what each can learn from the other. He's especially concerned about social and ecological issues. David, thanks for being with us once again.
Thank you, David. Great to be back. And let me just check, can everyone hear me okay? Great. The title for the talk I'd like to give this evening, and it's a new talk, is Opening the Clenched Fist in Your Mind, which is a reference to an enlightenment experience by an 18th century Japanese Buddhist nun named Taijitsu. I find it a very interesting and suggestive image, the idea of opening the clenched fist, but I won't actually be talking about that particular experience she had until further on toward the end. The question that I'd like to talk about, or the topic for the talk, is what is that metaphor really pointing at? How do we unclench the fist in our mind? How does Buddhist teaching and practice help us do that? And I'm going to start out by talking about what may be the most important way. And simply, I think that's meditation, if we really understand what's going on when we're meditating. But actually, that's an interesting way to put it, because can we really understand? In Zen, there's a lot of talk about don't know mind. And it seems to me that that actually applies to meditation itself. That there is something fundamentally mysterious about the process. You know, we do it, and over time, you know, things happen, change occurs, but we don't really understand how that happens. And after many years of Zazen, I'm convinced that the main action, if you will, or the main change, it's happening largely unconsciously. In other words, it's not something we do, it's not, again, something we can grasp. It's not an act of will. It's something that happens by itself. When the mind isn't so preoccupied as it usually is with doing something, or we could say with clenching it, grasping at something. And it doesn't mean that our minds need to be completely still or quiet for that to happen, as long as we keep returning to that stillness when we've wandered. Still, we do the best we can to avoid certain problems that can arise when we meditate, places where we get stuck, or you might say, even though we can understand meditation as a process of ungrasping, how nonetheless we can still embody a kind of grasping at the meditation that becomes sort of self-contradictory or creates problems. And what I'd like to talk about is briefly three, I don't know what to call them, problems maybe, binds, traps, syndromes, places, habits that we can sometimes develop that are often linked with each other, but ways, things that can interfere with our meditation, even that of experienced meditators. And by saying that, I certainly include myself. The first one is the bugaboo we're all familiar with, the tendency to constantly self-evaluate ourselves, including our practice, right? My meditation was really good today. Mind was very clear, very sharp, or my meditation was awful. You know, all these thoughts just came up again and again and again. I'm sure we're all familiar with that to some degree. And certainly, you know, at the beginning, when we're just learning how to meditate, there's a certain, maybe it's, there's some value in sort of getting a hang of what, of trying to understand what we're trying to do. But ultimately we have to say meditation is really the opposite of self-evaluation, in the sense that self-evaluation is just another version of self-reflexivity, right? You could say meditation is learning to let go of that constant, often habitual self-reflexivity, which is not easy to do because we're usually so inured to that, right? We're, for example, we tend to be also self-conscious about how we are affecting others, all right? Whether it's our appearance, or our personality, or our intelligence, or our accomplishments, or our status, whatever. We're constantly comparing ourselves. In fact, I think that's kind of built into the ego. Often caught in this trap of, well, low self-esteem for one, but maybe bouncing back and forth between vanity, narcissism, and low self-esteem. Again, I think this is very deep-rooted, because insofar as we have this sense of a separate self, which according to Buddhism is a, you know, fundamental delusion, it doesn't really exist. This sense of separate self is therefore, because it doesn't exist, it's going to be inherently insecure, not only insecure, but unable to be secured, insecurable, you might say, right? And so in meditation, we can understand that process and learn to sort of undo it. Meditation is a chance to become aware of the tendency to do that. And by sort of returning to the practice, whatever it is that we're concentrating on, a way to sort of undo that. So that any kind of self-imaging, self-evaluation, self-reflexivity, ultimately that is just one more thought, one more feeling, one more mental event that we learn to let go of. A second sort of trap, meditation trap, I think, is using Zazen, or that's the word we use in Zen for meditation, using meditation as a means to some other end. For example, trying to lower your blood pressure, or gain certain kind of equanimity, becoming less angry maybe, or certainly in my tradition, Kensho, which is this first glimpse of enlightenment, right? Now, of course, why do we begin to meditate? I mean, why do we invest so much time, energy, money, endure the pain of legs, back, whatever? I mean, obviously, we don't do it, most of us, just for fun, especially at the beginning. We do it because we're hoping to get something out of it, as it were, that it's going to serve a function. But the important thing about the meditation is that while we're actually meditating, it's really important to let go of all gaining ideas, as we say. Otherwise, that just becomes the perfect and self-stultifying example of that thinking that we're trying to undo, that we're trying to let go of. And of course, you can see how this concern to get something out of our meditation links so well with that, with what I just pointed at a moment ago, the self-reflexivity. Am I meditating well enough, right? Am I meditating well enough in order to get what I'm hoping to get out of it? That's how those two, I think, often fit together so well, right? But again, the idea that there's a goal, that the meditation is a means to attain some ends, that just becomes another thought, another way of thinking that intrudes, another event, another mental event that we need to let go of. In Zen, which is my own practice background, there are two main schools in Japan, the Rinzai and the Soto, and they reflect two different, very basic, different attitudes toward meditation, right? So for the Rinzai, we often work on what are called koans, or like these paradoxical questions. But the basic point is we're trying to have this glimpse, this first taste of awakening, which the koan can help us realize or experience. On the other hand, the other school, the Soto school, sometimes called Silent Illumination School, the emphasis in that one is what's called shikantaza, or just sitting without a goal. And based on the founder, Dogen, his insight that, you know, our practice really isn't about that, the best practice, that the essential nature of practice really, it's not about being a means to an end, but it is itself, our Zazen is itself a manifestation or an expression of our essential lacking nothing nature, which has nothing to gain and nothing to lose. So you can see how these would easily become incompatible extremes, right? Rinzai can be so goal-driven, but Soto too can become very sort of complacent, right? There's nothing to achieve, nothing to learn, you know. It can become very laid back and lose that kind of edge of focus. But in fact, I think they can, and at their best, do fit together in the sense that in my specific tradition, for example, Sambo Zen, you know, we do sit, we do meditate because there is this urge to wake up, to have kensho, this glimpse of enlightenment. But when we're actually meditating, it's important to let that go, as I was saying earlier, right? In other words, letting that desire go as we gently, naturally return to whatever it is that we're concentrating on, right? So in that sense, we don't reach or stretch for enlightenment, at least not at its best. And of course, I'm talking about an ideal here that, you know, isn't always the case. But instead of stretching or reaching for the enlightenment, we let that fruit drop when it is naturally ripe. So those are the first two sort of binds, or I think ways that we can import a kind of clenching into the practice, which is fundamentally about learning how to unclench. The third one, and maybe the most subtle, is thinking that the point of the path, the Buddhist path, the meditative path, is to grasp something, that enlightenment, awakening is about grasping something. Usually some insight, some conceptual understanding, you know, and this all, and, you know, I think many of us can have this sense that that's just something we're sort of on the edge. And if we can just get that, just realize, just grasp it, you know, then we'll be enlightened, right? And I think this is hard to see through, again, because this is the way that our minds tend to naturally work, right? In daily life, what are we doing? We're sort of grasping, if not physically, mentally, we're grasping at one thing after another in order to do things. That's just the way the mind works. And in fact, we often say things like, I can't quite grasp what you're saying or what you're pointing at. So when we import this into our Buddhist practice, we can end up thinking that, you know, something like enlightenment or awakening is like a truth to be grasped. Whereas again, the path is all about ungrasping. And it's interesting too, how this approach perpetuates a kind of problematical way of experiencing time, right? A dualistic way of experiencing that the now moment is valuable for trying to grab something in the future. Enlightenment is in the future. It hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen when I finally get it. Whereas just about every Buddhist teacher says, the realization is really about realizing something that's always been the case, as Dogen said, nothing to be gained or lost, nothing to be achieved that our essential nature doesn't get better or worse, right? So again, this third point about how we can think at the core of our practice, it's about grasping something, right? I think this can help us understand what is, to me, one of the most profound statements by perhaps the greatest of all Buddhist philosophers, Nagarjuna, who lived in the second century AD in India. He wrote this compendium, probably the most famous book of Buddhist philosophy, called the Mula Majjhimika Karika. And at the end of his chapter on nirvana, the last verse, he ends that and he says this, get this. And this is his, again, this is his chapter on nirvana. And he ends it by saying, quote, "No truth has been taught by any Buddha for anyone, anywhere. No truth has been taught by any Buddha for anyone, anywhere." What's he getting at there? You know, I think he's saying something, you know, truth as something we can grasp is not the way, that there's no such liberatory truth that can be grasped, right? I'm reminded here too of a koan, a famous koan in the Zen tradition, between two of the all-time greats, Joshu and Nansen. I'll just read the first part of it, but Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the way?" And Nansen said, "Ordinary mind is the way," right? It's like you can say in Zen, it's very clear, the goal of the practice is to become an ordinary person, right? And then Joshu says, "Well, should I try to turn toward it or not?" And Nansen, the master here, says, "If you try to turn toward it, it will turn away from you." I guess that can be understood different ways, but again, the idea that if you try to grasp it, it will run away from you. It will escape you. You won't be able to grasp it, right? So if awakening isn't something that can be grasped, where does that leave us, right? Well, here I have to go back to something I often end up quoting because I think it expresses the path so well. It's something that Dogen wrote about in his Shobogenzo. He said, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, to study the Buddha way is to study yourself. To study yourself is to forget yourself. To forget yourself is to perceive your intimacy with or your non-duality with all things. To realize this is to cast off the body and mind of self and others, is to allow your body and mind and the body and mind of others to drop away. Again, clearly he's pointing, I think, to this unclenching. It's about letting go of your sense of separate self, which is not something you can directly do, because the self that does it is the dualism. That's the fundamental problem. So how do you do it? Well, this is where the meditation comes in. And of course, there are many ways to meditate, but I'd like to say a little bit about the version that's most familiar to me as a longtime Zen student working on the Koan Mu. My Zen teacher in Japan, Yamada Koen, used to say, the way to forget yourself is to become one with something. And that's the basic idea of Mu. Mu is a koan in the sense that there's a kind of question built into it when you understand it in a certain way. But in terms of meditating on it, actually, it can be treated as a kind of mantra, that is to say something that you would just recite over and over again, right? You become one with Mu, that is to say, by reciting it over and over again, as a way of letting go of everything else that tends to arise in the mind. You immerse yourself in this practice in that way. And fundamentally, the idea is trusting the process, not trying to manipulate it or figure it out or whatever. The best way is simply to trust the process, to keep returning to the now, returning to the mu, without desire or expectation whenever the mind has been wandering, right? So again, the idea here is mu. Think of it as just a sound, not a sound that you recite out loud, although that's also possible in some situations, but basically something that you say inside your mind, along with exhalations. When you inhale, you kind of keep the mind steady, but when you exhale, there would be just this sound of, again, in the mind, not out loud, moo. And it's very interesting, the different stages that happen naturally if you do this, for example, during a retreat, for example, a Zen session, when you're able to focus on this pretty much nonstop for what, 5 or 7 days, whatever. The idea is at the beginning, you're trying to focus on mu, just return to this sound of mu, but there's many, many other thoughts, of course, feelings, all kinds of mental events that arise. And when they do, and you remember what's going on, then you go back to the sound of mu. So at this first stage, there's you trying to focus on mu and all these other things going on in the mind. But if you continue long enough, what happens is the focus on mu deepens and you're not losing it or not losing it so much. It's like, whereas before you would say mu and then the mind would wander. But if you really keep focusing, you're able to hold on to mu. And again, it's a kind of clenching, but it's a way of clenching on this one thing as a way of letting go of everything else, right? So you hold on to the mu, and even though other thoughts, feelings, some of that may tend to arise, you let them go because you're focused on just that sound and you're able to keep that. And if you continue that, something even deeper eventually happens where it's called the stage of ripeness and purity, when both inside and outside naturally fuse. In other words, the sense that there's a me, that I am reciting mu or focusing on mu, the sense that there's an I that's doing the sound of mu, those two things kind of merge. And there's, at this point, there's not the sense of an I that's doing it, there's just mu, right? This stage is sometimes described as saying that here, mu is doing mu, that mu is sitting, or when you stand up, mu stands up, or when you eat, mu is eating, or when you go to sleep, mu is lying down to sleep, right? And if one perseveres with this, again, you can get to the place where there's a kind of sensation. Maybe I shouldn't emphasize this too much because it doesn't always happen, but sometimes there's this sense of like being on the edge of the precipice, kind of dangling by a thread, in which case the point is, again, plunge yourself, throw yourself completely into mu, right? At this point, it's interesting, this helps to understand some of those classical Zen stories that so many of us are familiar with, right? The idea is that a Zen teacher or even some sort of natural event can kind of cut that last thread. An unexpected action or a blow or a shout or even a few quiet words or a sound, it can startle the student, right? Remember, the student is just focused, can startle the student in a way that the student lets go, even lets go of mu completely. This is known, and then I'm going to quote Hakuin here. All of a sudden, he finds his mind and body wiped out of existence together with the koan. This is what is known as letting go your hold. This is the unclenching that Taijutsu is talking about, right? I mean, so many of the classical Zen stories talk about this, right? I remember one in particular, there was a student who went in for a private interview with the teacher, and the teacher pushed him out of the room and slammed the door. And slamming the door, I think it broke or it really hurt the ankle. And it was that experience, that sudden pain, that helped the student to let go. There was another famous instance where a student went off by himself and he was meditating, and he used to sweep the yard every morning. And once he swept it, and a little pebble was thrown up and it hit a bamboo, that just that talk and just that little subtle sound was enough at this point, because he was so concentrated, right? The unexpected sensation causes it penetrates to the very core of one's being. In other words, experienced non-dually, the sense of the self that is experiencing the sound, the sense that there's an I inside that hears the sound, there's just the sound, right? So letting go here, obviously that's another metaphor for ungrasping, letting go of the grasp, which is what we're constantly normally doing. Another way to talk about this is to say that we experience our groundlessness. And the most common word for that in Buddhism is shunyata, emptiness. To have this experience, to sort of let yourself go, is to experience your emptiness, that there's not a self, it's just... I'm reminded here of an Advaitin, not a Buddhist, but actually an Advaita teacher named Annamalai Swami. When he was asked what liberation felt like, he said, "It feels like zero gravity. Nothing is pulling you anymore." And this reminds me also of that famous line from Chögyam Trungpa, comparing enlightenment to falling out of an airplane. He said, "The bad news is there's no parachute. The good news is there's no ground, no ground," a kind of groundlessness, a kind of freedom. There's nothing, there's no self that needs to be secured, perpetuated, taken care of. And finally, then, this brings us to that quotation from which I've got the title for this talk, this account. I don't know if it's by Teijutsu herself or if it's attributed to her, but anyway, I find it very, very moving. Again, this 18th century abbess. Here's the quotation. Here's the passage. "She saw that phenomena arose, abided, and fell away." And I guess I should explain, by phenomena, anything that it can be a sense perception, it can be a thought, a feeling, a memory, a plan, a hope, a fear, any phenomenon, right? That's what she's talking about. All of her experience, she says. So I'll say it again. "She saw that phenomena arose, abided, and fell away. And she saw that knowing this, her knowing this, arose, abided, and passed away. Then she knew there was nothing more than this, no ground, nothing to lead on stronger than the cane she held. Nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning." And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. Nothing to lean upon at all and no leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. Letting go. So again, her experience isn't that she understood. Well, there's an understanding at the beginning, right? But then she lets go. Then this clenched fist opens, right? It's not some kind of intellectual truth that she holds on to, but it's like that realization, just the opposite. It helped her let go. And this reminds me of the final thing I want to talk about, which is another kind of illustration of this. And if I knew how to do Zoom better, I would, I could show this to you as a, how are we gonna do this? Show this to you. Can people see what I'm holding up here? It's a famous painting by again, Hakuin, one of the most famous of all Japanese Zen masters, who was also a great famous painter. And this is one of his most famous paintings. I don't know how clearly you can see it, but basically what's going on here, you have a monkey, and the monkey is holding on to a branch, but he's also reaching for something. And what he's reaching for is the reflection of the moon in the water. So there's the monkey, he's holding on, he's clenching, and he's reaching for something, right? And if what I've just been saying makes any sense, you will be able to understand Hakuin's poem. He wrote a poem about what the monkey is doing. This is how it goes. Both the poem and the painting are very, very famous in Japanese Zen. The monkey is reaching for the moon in the water. Until death overtakes him, he'll never give up. But if he just let go the branch and disappear into the deep pool, the whole world would shine with dazzling pureness. He's reaching for the moon. If he would just let go of himself, disappear into the water, not just fall into it. He says, disappear into the water, into the deep pool. The whole world would shine. That would be his awakening. That would be his enlightenment. But in order to do it, he's got to unclench that fist. So I'll leave it at that for the moment. Thank you.
David, how you open to some comments and questions and reflections?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Great. And just in case any of you aren't familiar with how to do that, you can raise a hand in one of a couple of ways, depending on which Zoom program you have. On the bar across the bottom of your screen, for some of you, if you click on the word participants, that will bring up an icon of a hand that says raise hand on it in the lower right corner of your screen. Some of you also might be able to click on reactions on that bar across the bottom, which in some cases will also bring up a hand. And when you do that, I'll be able to see that you've raised your hand, at which point I'll call your name and invite you to unmute so David and everyone else can hear your comment or reflection or question. So take a moment and see if there's any aspect of what David's been speaking about that you'd like to unpack a little further or share a comment about or ask a question about. This is probably only relevant for those of us who would like to be enlightened. I see Deb has a hand up. Would you go ahead and unmute, please, Deb?
I'm just curious, David. Moo, is it a sound and a sound only, like do, re, mi? Or is there any word connected or concept or anything?
Yeah, that. Thank you for that. Yeah, actually, it's rather more complicated than I said. Okay, the word mu, which is the Chinese equivalent, it's the Japanese equivalent of the Chinese wu, which is a kind of negative prefix meaning un or no, you know, it's like not, but it you don't usually find it by itself. So, but the importance that what's emphasized when you work on it as something you repeat is that you don't think of it, you don't think of that meaning. You just let all the meaning go and just focus on the pure sound. But just to make it even more complicated, it's actually it comes from a famous Zen story where a student asked the great Japanese master, the great Chinese master, Joshu, whom I already cited once, right? That dialogue with Nansen. In the koan, Joshu asks, Joshu is asked, now he's the great master, and a student asked him, is it true that a dog has Buddha nature? You know, it's a kind of philosophical question. In some Buddhist teachings, they talk about all sentient beings have Buddha nature. And so the student asked Dogen, does a dog really have Buddha nature, the same nature as a Buddha? And Joshu's reply, all he did was moo or un or woo. It's like, how do you understand that? In a way, you could say he's saying, don't go there. Like, you know, don't get caught up in that philosophy. But basically the way it has come down is as I described, that we use it as a sound, a pure sound, one syllable, notice, a pure sound as a way to focus on. And in doing so, it's a way to let go of everything else. And that's kind of important because it's possible to meditate in a way that you push away thoughts, but that's dualistic, right? You're creating a sense of duality between the mind that's pushing away the thoughts and the thoughts or whatever other mental phenomena. And this process is very different and more subtle in the sense that you just return to the mu, just return to that pure sound and just keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. And then those three stages that I talked about sort of unfold naturally as you do that.
Because it sounds, when you say it, it sounds like the air letting out of a balloon.
Yes, well, that's good because you're supposed to say it with exhalations, like you're meditating. Okay, you got a bunch of Zen monks, you're actually quiet. But when you're in inhaling, you keep the mind steady. In other words, you're not thinking about anything. But when you're exhaling naturally, when you exhale in your mind, that's when you say the sound. And you do kind of keep it going. It's not just moo, but moo, as long as you are exhaling. That's the sort of best way to do it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Now, I feel a little uncomfortable now realizing, I mean, that process, it's important if you want to do that process to work on it with a teacher rather than by yourself, because, you know, problems can arise, things can come up. So although I've just talked about the process, I'm not encouraging anyone to go off by yourself for a week in a cave and do it. It's important to have some way of connecting with some teacher who can help you there and advise you if as questions come up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks, Deb.
Thanks for the question.
Hal, would you go ahead and unmute, please?
Hi, it's actually Lou. You can't see me because it's so dark in here.
Oh, that's okay, Lou. Now we know you're not Hal. We know you're Lou.
He's here too, but I'm the one asking the question.
Okay.
I'm just curious because I don't know. I'm new to Buddhism in general. I'm just curious about why David was drawn to Zen. Like, what is it about Zen Buddhism? I don't know much about it. So why gravitate toward this type of Buddhism rather than another? I'm just curious.
Yeah, a good question. Well, I think there's two sides to that answer. Part of it is just the time that I started practicing. You know, it was in the early 70s. And at that time, I think the kind of Buddhism with the highest profile was Zen, the late 60s and early 70s. And that's what kind of what I was exposed to. And so I think that that made a difference. I was living in Hawaii at the time, and there was a really good Zen teacher, a couple Zen centers. So it was very convenient. The other side, though, is Zen has a kind of aesthetic, a kind of simplicity to it that I have always found attractive. In other words, you know, Tibetan Buddhism is fascinating, but it's a kind of complicated culturally, visually, and so forth. That never attracted me in the same way that the Zen simplicity did. Now, if I were starting today, I might well go into insight, what's called insight, you know. But at the time I started, you know, I'm an old guy now. At the time I started, insight as it exists now didn't, you know, that had yet to be formed. The people who created that movement were like me, just finding their way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Lou. Dahlia, go ahead and unmute, please.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, David, for your talk. I've recently been learning a lot more about Zen. And so I've just got a question that I hope isn't personal, but the typical average day that you have, how much of your day would you say that you're able to be in the present moment?
Ouch. Oh, ouch. Do I tell the truth?
What you're not supposed to have.
The reality is, and I'm going to tell the truth, I'm always in the present moment, but I don't always know it.
Sure,
you know, my mind wanders, and I mean, and I don't even know if wandering, yeah, it certainly wanders, but also, you know, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. And so you do need to plan, but there's different ways to do that. It's like, you know, one can get so caught up in the future that you're not experiencing right now, but also, you know, you can experience the now in a way that just develops in that direction. So does that really answer your question?
Yeah, I guess I've just wondered what that's like for someone that has been able to, you know, bring oneself into the present moment more and more. I understand it's moments of enlightenment, not necessarily an all or none proposition.
Very much in Zen, right.
We talk about that. But then I wondered, what is it like to have to, you know, to do all the plan, and especially in our culture, we are so focused on the future and thinking months and years in advance. How does one hold all of that? So that's been a challenge.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. You know, I think two things that go very well together are the meditation, when you're just doing that and nothing else, and then being mindful throughout the day. It's like washing the dishes, you know. I can wash the dishes, trying to get them done as quickly as possible so I can get to whatever the next thing is. Or I can wash the dishes just to wash the dishes and they still get done. You know, it's like, I think the mindfulness can be cultivated in those situations. And even if it's not meditating throughout the day, I think just coming back to what it is that we're doing, that I think that becomes the most helpful. But I also find, you know, if I don't meditate, usually in the morning for me, then I notice I tend to be less mindful and the mind will wander more. Yeah. You're asking very big questions about time. I'm fascinated by that too, but maybe I'll leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, Dalia. Yeah.
John, would you go ahead and unmute, please?
Hello, David.
Hi, John.
And David.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk, and thank you for leading the meditation, David and David. About 50 years ago, I asked Bhante Gunaratana a question, which went something like, how much of the time do you spend meditating? He looked at me with a little bit of a surprise on his face and said, all of life is meditation. So that was his answer to a similar sort of question. I wanted to comment on the first hindrance or trap that you mentioned in meditating, which is a tendency to constantly be comparing and evaluating one sit to the other, or one meditator to another meditator, or oneself to others. And the comment comes from the section on the Muni, or the one who was stilled and calmed, in the Sutta Nipata, where the Buddha is describing one who is stilled. He says, this is one of wisdom who does not compare himself to another as superior or inferior or equal. There is nothing in him that he holds on to as his, and nothing that he rejects as not his. He has given up all craving to exist and all craving not to exist. He does not engage in speculative views. So that's advice to let go of this mind of comparison.
So that's a wonderful passage. Thank you for sharing that, John. I didn't know about it, but I'm definitely going to look it up. Yeah, that's great.
Thanks.
No.
Anyone else who has a comment or a reflection or question related to David's talk, or practice related questions?
I only discovered that.
Hold on, David. We've got one more here.
Please, let's go for it. Yeah.
I see Laura, you have a hand up. Would you like to go ahead and unmute, please?
Thank you for your talk, David. I don't really know very much about Zen. So I was wondering if you could recommend a book.
As a retired professor, I love it when people ask questions like that. But, you know, when I started Zen practice, there were all the books in English on Zen, you could fit them in one shelf, but it ain't that way now. So if you wanted to follow up on the kind of thing that I was talking about today, about working on Mu, and so forth, I think the classic book still is called The Three Pillars of Zen, edited by Philip Kaplow, K-A-P-L-E-A-U. And that really talks about the kind of practice as I did it, and, you know, talks about working on Mu and how that actually happens in a retreat with a teacher. Goes into some detail. So if you're interested in how that kind of practice is done, that's the ideal book. You know, if you're more philosophical, there are other ones, but I still love that book, even though it's not perfect, you know, that's the first thing that comes to mind. If you wanted to be more specific about what you were looking for, I could maybe suggest something else. But in general, that's what I would suggest.
Yeah, thank you. I remember I think I might have even had this book at one point, but I think it was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, or something like that.
Right. So that is, that's a compilation of talks by Shinryu Suzuki, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. And it's interesting that we have these two books because they exemplify kind of the two types of Zen. On the one hand, the Three Pillars is about working on Mu and talks about people who've had Kensho. They describe their experiences. Whereas the Soto approach, you know, you sit with no gaining ideas, nothing to gain, nothing to lose, no better, no worse. That's exemplified by Shinryu Suzuki in that book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So you, they go well together. They kind of complement each other, but in and of themselves, they're quite different.
Yeah. Thank you.
Welcome.
David, maybe you could say a little bit about the notion of gradual awakening and sudden awakening as it's understood in the Zen context.
Well, again, yeah. To some degree, those two different schools that I talked about exemplify the difference in that in the Rinzai and also in Sambo Zen, which is what I trained in, there's very much the emphasis on Kensho. And Kensho is kind of by definition, something sudden. It's something happens, you know. Mm-hmm. There's some realization. It's like that letting go. I think the quotation from Taijitsu, and then she let go of the fist in her mind, that would be a moment of Kensho. And it sounds like a very deep one. Now, Kensho, which literally means seeing into your nature or, you know, seeing your true nature, there's different degrees. There's, you know, it can be like just a tip of the tongue taste, but it can also be much, much, much deeper. And my Zen teacher used a wonderful metaphor here. He said, imagine that your teacher told you, he gave you a cloth and told you to polish a wall. Polish a wall. And, you know, what the heck? You know, it's like this wall. Well, it's plaster. What do you mean polish the wall? And, but you do what the teacher says, you know, and you polish the wall. And then at a certain point, you realize that, hey, it's not a wall. It's actually, you can see through it, that it's actually a pane of glass that is being covered up with crud, with mud, with dirt, with whatever, with paint, with whatever. So meditation would be the polishing, and that Kensho would be the that glimpse. But obviously at the beginning, it's just going to be a glimpse. There's something on the other side, but you can't really see it very well. Mm-hmm. So the importance then is to continue the polishing, mm-hmm. to continue so that the glass, you wipe away all of the impurities that are on the glass. Mm-hmm. And that's important because, you know, what can sometimes happen is people have that initial glimpse and they think, oh, you know, now I'm enlightened, and, you know, you can become quite complacent or even dangerous to your students. But if you keep polishing and then you get this, you can see much more clearly that it is a plane of glass. And then he said the what's called Daigo Tete in Japanese, the great enlightenment is when the glass is smashed and there's no longer anything between you on the other side. So in a way that combines the, well, it does a couple of things. It's a way of metaphorically talking about different degrees of awakening, but you can see the relationship between the instantaneity of the glimpse and also the great awakening, but also the importance of the polishing to clarify and make it as clear as possible. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Last call. Comments, questions? or reflections?
You know, I have one reflection, which is, you know, the difficulty of trying to express how much of our daily life is a kind of self, or our usual way of being is a kind of self-reflexive grasping at ourself, you know, and how, you know, sometimes I talk about that in terms of lack projects, how this usual but deluded sense of self, it always feels insecure. So there's always a sense of trying to secure ourselves, trying to make ourselves feel more real, and how the awakening that Buddhism is talking about, in a way, is the collapse of that project. It's the letting go, the realization that there's nothing that needs to be made real, nothing that needs to be gained, just unclenching that fist in our mind, and as Taijutsu did, sort of falling into the everything.
Well, it's about 5 minutes to nine. How about if we do a very brief dedication of merit together as a way of closing our evening? And then we can perhaps unmute for a few moments of mindful chaos and greeting one another. Yeah. Just take a moment and temporarily let go of the concepts and ideas and come back into that present moment that we've talked about. Recognizing that there's a tremendous amount to contemplate in what David has shared. And at the same time, rather than try to hold on to it in the grasping style he was talking about, just let it settle like snowflakes in a snow globe after you stop shaking it and put it down on a table. And allow yourself to settle back into the present moment briefly, with a simple sense of appreciation and gratitude, perhaps, for the blessing and opportunity we share to be able to come together this way and to use technology in the way that we are, to connect as a sangha, as a practice community. And in addition to our good fortune and recognizing how blessed we are, let's also take a moment to remember that the process of spiritual awakening is a seamless process in which our work on ourselves in support of our own happiness and well-being is simultaneously a process that enables us to move out into the world as instruments of happiness and service and well-being. Ram Dass referred to that as becoming a self-sharpening instrument in which we do our inner work with the understanding that it's both an act of self-love and self-support, and also an act of generosity and a gift to the world. So I'll close for the moment with the words of one of the great exemplars of the Bodhisattva path who understands this so well, Thich Nhat Hanh. Studying the teachings, practicing the way of awareness gives rise to benefits without limit. We vow to share the fruits with all beings. We vow to offer tribute to parents, teachers, friends, and numerous beings who give guidance and support along the path. May it be so. And as I mentioned, if you'd like to unmute and just greet a friend or say a few words and remind all of us that we are more than images on a screen, please feel free to do that.
Thank you, Davids.
Yes, thank you both, Davids.
Thanks, David.
Yes.
Thank you, David and David.
Thank you both.
Who's that? Yeah.
Thank you.
It's the Sangha. I think we all really appreciate what you two Davids do. Thank you.
Feels like Laurel and Hardy right now.
Thank you for the generosity of your wisdom and the wisdom of your generosity.
Night, night.
Good night, everybody.
Be well. Bye. Stay healthy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
See you Friday morning. You know, those morning meditations are wonderful. Join us if you can.
Everybody stay safe and healthy. We'll see you next time. David, I'll be in touch, huh?
Great.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.